afternoon. It's Friday, the 16th of June 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish, with me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And we're delighted to be joined today by David Scott, who'll be reporting, of course, from north of the border with Northern Exposure. And we've also got David Ellis from Strategic Defence Initiatives.
I'm just going to say I'm aware there's a problem with your mic. And okay. we're going to fix it at the first opportunity, but we'll go straight into the news here. What have we got? Well, the latest numbers that are starting to appear over the Grenfell thing, it is 100 possible, but according to Lily Allen on Channel 4 News, 150 possible. But the mainstream media not commenting on this. They're sticking with the official figure, which is 17. If you get a chance to have a look at this interview that Jon Snow did with Lily Allen on Channel 4 News last night, she is pretty critical of the way that the mainstream media is playing down the numbers of casualties in this. It's pretty clear that a lot of people did not get out of the building. But the mainstream media playing down the situation. Somebody said to me earlier on today, Brian, Scott is the best person to ask about this, but somebody said to me earlier on that when the event is genuine, they play down the casualty numbers, you know, because obviously there are more implications for the officials involved if the numbers are higher. I can't really explain why they insist on doing this.
It's very strange. There was a woman from the area who was interviewed on, I think it was the BBC, and she was talking about potentially 50 children being casualties, being fatalities, and perhaps as many as 200 total residents killed in this. I could only speculate as to why the media is still fixated on numbers in the teens, and without admitting that it's in fact going to be very much worse than that. The nature of the event meant that very quickly the fire plan that is standard practice for dealing with high rise blazes was clearly not going to work because of the failure of the cladding and the very rapid fire spread. So someone on the ground had to take the decision to bin the plan and react to what they were seeing in front of them. And as so often in the case with new and unusual situations, somebody instead stuck to the plan. They kept it to the book. They played it by the book, and they played it wrongly by the book because they felt unable to really just your heads up and decide what the appropriate response was to the situation they had in front of them, which was abnormal, as the cladding performance was abnormal.
Yes. We'll comment a bit more on the mainstream media coverage of this, because this is the Telegraph saying he survived a SAD only to be killed in a tar block in London. First victim of Grenfell fire is Syrian refugee Muhammad Al-Haj Ali, they say that he was a civil engineering student from West London, separated from his older brother Omar on the stairs as they tried to escape, and that his family friend of his, Abdulaziz Al-Mashi, who is the co-founder of the UK-based Syrian Solidarity Campaign, they quote him extensively and so on. And the point here is that the media here taking advantage of the situation to twist the story to become an anti-Assad hit piece, really, and that's a bit unfortunate.
Well, I think it's despicable, Mike. We are just seeing really horrible things being done in the press at the moment. I mean, to not tell the truth is probably one of the worst things, but every single article, there's some sort of political spin which is trying to put the government's line across.
Yeah,
I'm going to come on to this in a bit, in a moment, where we're going to be talking about some of the things that the Grenfell Action Group had to say. And I think there's some really astonishing things to come out of that.
Right. And just finally to mention that, the Queen and Prince William have visited today I'm not certain what they can do, really, other than just offer condolences.
Well, Mike, we've got to say at least they did turn up and talk to residents. And from what I've read in the press, so I'm going to say I think it's true, but whether it is or not, that the Prime Minister didn't take the time to actually speak to residents on the ground. So at least the Queen has done that. And, you know, that takes some courage to do, because obviously these are very distressed people.
Okay, well, look, we're going into your section now. So, and this is live, folks. So while you're doing that, I'll fix your microphone.
Okay.
So you go ahead.
Right. Well, let's just come back on what we reported yesterday, which was we were pointing out that the communities in for the Grenfell Tower block were saying that they simply weren't being listened to. And what we and one of the speakers had said live on camera that not only were they not listened to, that it wasn't simply a question of the fire in the tower block. They'd been talking about other issues around the supposed regeneration of the area, and nobody was taking any notice of them. And what we said is this is the exact pattern for everywhere that the New Labour New Deal for Communities initiative between 1999 and 2008, wherever that took place, you saw the adaptation of this very bullying, dismissive response by local authorities. So this was part of the last report on that New Deal for Communities programme, and you can find that online and read it. We showed in a diagram how these various bits fitted together, and what we said was going on was a massive social engineering programme through New Deal to bring in control from the European Union, but also to bring in this centralised government control, which was driven in via government offices for the regions and the regional development agencies. Now, let's take this a step further, because thank you very much to the lady that highlighted some words from the Grenfell Action Group, and they said this. We find it more than a little sinister that West London citizens, which is a subset of Citizens UK, absolute newcomers to the North Kensington housing debate, were able to persuade with apparent ease the most powerful figures from the council and the tenant management organisation to attend this regeneration event, while local residents groups have struggled for years to get the attention of the same figures, never mind their actual attendance at a local meeting. So here were local people saying, we're being pushed out of the debate. The council doesn't want to talk to us, but it will talk to some organisation called West London Citizens, later to become Citizens UK. Now, we'd encourage people to go and research this yourself, read what these individuals have said. This is part of the Grenfell Action Group blog, and here they are with the headline, West London Citizens and Kensington and Chelsea Tenant Management Organisation. And they are highlighting the fact that Cameron was driving in part of his big society, which was pushing out the views of local people for this political agenda. So if I put some of this together in a UK column diagram, we've got the social housing communities in North Kensington. This is the real people. They became aware of this organisation, West London Citizens, and they were particularly upset that this organisation could put in housing inquiry report while they were simply cut out of the equation. So that report submitted to Kensington and Chelsea Council. The picture inserted there is the leader of the council. We'll show him in a bit more detail in a minute. But they also worked out, local people worked out, the West London Citizens, part of this big society drive of David Cameron, Citizens UK. And if you go and look at those at Citizens UK, you come into the Living Wage Foundation. That's just a little insert to prove the link between those two. And who are you then dealing with? Well, it's just astonishing, because the chief executive is chief executive of the advisory part of this Living Wage is Aviva, the biggest general insurance company
in the country. We've got KPMG, we've got GSK, we've got Nestle. So all of a sudden, it's not local people that have been taking putting the input. What we've got is David Cameron's social engineering backed by these vast corporate interests. So let's bring on the leader of the council. Here's a mirror headline from today or yesterday. Shameless Tory council leader blames Grenfell Tower block residents for lack of sprinklers, claiming they didn't want disruption. So this man who's been in dialogue not with the residents, but through his council with these vast corporate interests, is how can you do this, Mike? You at this time, you try and blame it on the residents. It's just simply outrageous. And before we get some comment back on that, on this, let's add in this bit, because when you get into this, who do you find the Citizens UK chief executive intimately linked with, no less than Common Purpose? And what is he saying in his blog back in 2015, that we've got to collaborate with these special leaders to change the whole way city societies work? So once again, we are finding local people pushed to the side. The big corporate interests come in on the back of government and EU policy. And of course, as we're always warning, the driver in the background is Common Purpose. So wherever we're seeing happy communities breaking down, inevitably we're seeing Common Purpose at work. And it takes the work of the local people to actually dig out the truth in the first place. So this is another part of a blog where they're identifying West London citizens, a subset of Citizens UK, and brilliant description because they're describing it as a cuckoo, which is actually bringing in effectively communitarian big society and pushing out ordinary people. This is probably a good point to bring in. David Ellis, just this is becoming obvious that we're actually seeing a deeply sinister embedded government control affecting every area of society. And in this case, it has dulled the warnings of the community that there was going to be a serious fire.
Correct. This is now, people are seeing that there's a shadow arrangement, a shadow government in effect behind the facade of these alleged sort of political personalities, if you want to call them that, or party representatives. So all of the decision making is being done by non-elected closed groups behind the scenes. And this is across the spectrum. So this is in this instance exactly the same as what we're seeing in other fields. But I really do have to say, Brian, would you be able to put that slide back up of the leader of the council? Are you able to do that?
Yes, we can do that. Hold on a second. There he is.
Am I to understand he's going down the avenue here of apportioning blame to the poor people that have died in this incident? This is their fault.
This is absolutely correct. And somebody has just posted in our chat room that he was appalling when he was interviewed. But what interests me is that previously we now know that his counsel, I can't say whether he was present in all the meetings, although I know he was present in some. This man was meeting with these vast David Cameron corporate interests through the vehicle of Citizens UK. This is very, when you follow it through, you could say it's a failure of separation of the powers, or else there is something very, very dirty going on in that we've got public sector people who should be protecting the interests of the people living in their council area are actually paying attention to big corporate interests, including insurers.
You're just quite, it's a correct comment. I mean, I've got to say that this guy really needs those local people there to take him to task. You know, that's unacceptable what he said there.
Absolutely.
So, now, his position is, frankly, from my point of view, is untenable. He needs to consider his position. But it's just the most outrageous thing that I've ever heard.
Right. Now, I'm going to put on screen, and several people have said, my goodness, Brian isn't wearing a tie. Well, the reason I'm not wearing a tie is just before we were ready to go in the studio, I got a phone call saying, I have an email I'd like to send you. And I think this is so significant. So we've seen in the Grenville Tower fire that warnings by the residents were suppressed. Well, this is a copy of an email that was sent into Sheffield City Council a matter of hours before the Grenville fire. And it's it provided an attachment which listed out the cases and risks of fires in these sorts of tower blocks and other council property. So here's the email basically saying, note the heads up of the warning. And this was part of the attachment. Now on the left, this is giving information about fires at various locations. But at the end of this document that was sent to Sheffield City Council, this was the last warning. Revealed external panels, probable cause of huge tower block fire spread. And that's relating to a fire that took place last year. So,
last year?
Yes, if you read it at the bottom there, I'll just read it. Councils have been warned over the use of insulation panels on high-rise buildings after tests revealed they're likely to have caused a devastating fire to rip through a tower block last year. So the person who contacted me said, Brian, I wanted to share this with you because I warned Sheffield City Council a matter of hours before the Grenville tower block fire that there were these immense risks.
So nobody can say that there was no awareness?
Nobody can say there was no awareness, Mike. But the other point I wanted to ram home is that when ordinary, if I may use that term, decent people using their common sense warn what is happening, they are suppressed by this vicious social control which we are seeing coming in through David Cameron, Theresa May's big society. This is very dangerous stuff. David, I don't know whether you'd like to come back in on that.
Yeah, there's several points you raised there I think are very important. Firstly, you mentioned insurers. The role of the insurance industry is vital here because ultimately what dictates what goes into these buildings is very often what can be insured. There is an insurer called Factory and Mutual who insures a great deal of the industrial properties around the UK. Their standards for what insulation can be used are different from the building regulations. They are much more onerous than the building regulations. They apply those higher standards. And if you don't do better than the building regulations, you don't get insured. And that has driven the standard in industrial buildings higher than the regulators would drive it. And that's about loss control. That's about not paying out, which is an entirely sensible response to the problem. If the insurers can be pressured by public opinion to take different views on the materials that are being used, we'll see some very rapid changes. Now, there's another aspect here that's going to come out, I think, very slowly, if at all. The construction industry and the materials manufacturing industry is very close to the regulators. In the same people both run or work for the manufacturers of materials such as insulation, and sit on the regulatory bodies, for example, at the EU, who are coming up with the requirements and the tests. And what we're seeing is, to at least some extent, the testing is being developed in order to sell the products. So the tests are made suitable for individual products to show those products in the best light. And you're seeing people who are sitting around coming up with the regulations are also and have an interest in sales, in material sales. So there's a conflict of interest there. So we're seeing people coming up with the regulations and selling the products to those regulations. When you see this very close association between private industry and government regulation using force, then there's a huge tendency for this to be used to exclude competition and to promote a sort of monopoly position and monopoly sales. And this is not obviously working in the interest of the public.
David, just very quickly, this morning on Radio 4, the comment was made that the cost, the additional cost of cladding this building in something which was non-flammable would only have been £5,000. First of all, does that seem like a likely figure to you. And but the bigger issue is then, you know, can we suggest, is it reasonable to suggest that if the difference in the price between the two products was only £5,000, then there must be something else going on, some kind of insider deal going on here.
I have no idea if the £5,000 is a reasonable figure or not. It's a big area. The external cladding cost was £2.6 million just for the cladding. I don't know whether it'd be £5,000, but what it very well could have been is a very small amount. There are not huge price differences between materials which are inherently fire safe, like rock wool, and the materials that were used. Now, here it's the outer cladding that's of particular interest in this case, although the whole construction is an issue. But the outer cladding, similar materials were available with very inert mineral fiber core rather than a polyethylene core. So things that would be inherently fire safe and fire resistant. So these materials were available, and they were available at an economic cost. So this was not an inevitable consequence of undertaking the work. This was a consequence of using the wrong materials in the wrong place.
Okay. Well, I think that leads on nicely to the fact that if the views and opinions and warnings of the Grenfell residents were suppressed, what we're really talking about is suppression of free speech.
Yes, David, we've got a number of articles here, and this one here from Haaretz, declaring war on academia. And you're concerned about how free speech and debate is being controlled at the moment?
Very much so. We're seeing this all across the globe. Now, this one in Israel I thought was particularly interesting, because what we're seeing is the right wing in Israel using the same approaches that the left wing in Britain and America and Canada has been doing for decades to silence free speech at universities. So what they're saying is, well, we're going to introduce a code of practice about what is right, what is sayable, what is acceptable from professors.
A new ethical code of practice.
The ethical code of practice. So if you have the wrong opinions, if you say something that they don't agree with, you're not wrong. You're not in error. You're not opening up an area for debate. No, you're unethical to even say this. This is how the left in British universities, and particularly Canadian ones, has been shutting down debate, because people get no platform. The left's cry is, you're racist, you're homophobic, you are against women, you're against Muslims, you're against something, so you must be silenced, so you're not allowed to speak at all. Here you see it coming from the right in Israel. So if you are taking the wrong political stance, as they see it, regarding the occupation of the West Bank, regarding boycott, divest and sanctions campaigns against the Israeli government, if you say or do or associate yourself with any of these ideas, then you are behaving unethically, and you'll be shut down and disciplined, presumably, perhaps sacked, because of your unethical behaviour. So it's silencing debate. It's silencing any sort of opposing ideas being expressed, ultimately being considered.
We can follow this on with a couple of headlines here. A Canadian university professor under fire for what is being described as a rant on political correctness, and Toronto University caves to students who are demanding anti-PC prof use correct gender pronouns.
Now, I really encourage people, if they're not familiar with this gentleman, his name is Jordan Peterson. He's a professor at a Canadian university, I think in Alberta, and he is formerly from Harvard. He's a psychology professor and a very, very fascinating intellect. And he's speaking out. In fact, he's drawn the line in the sand, as he sees it, at some laws which are currently going through the parliament in Canada. Now, these laws are not simply to say what you can't say. They are to compel speech. They're telling you what you must say. So if you refuse to use someone's made-up gender pronoun because they regard themselves as some sort of strange gender that's all to their own imagination or view or whatever, and you don't agree with that, and you think they're a he or a she, and you refer to them as such, the law that's coming forward will actually criminalise that. You will be fined initially, And once the fine's administered, if you refuse to pay the fine, you can go to jail for contempt of court. And he's pointing this out, and he's saying he will not comply with this. He spent 40 years studying the rise of totalitarianism, and this is how it starts, and he will not comply. He will not pay the fine if it's administered, and if they send him to jail, he will go on hunger strike. He is not going to budge in this. A very impressive man with exploring very interesting ideas about where this is coming from, and it's not about gender pronouns. It's about the ability to speak freely, to exchange ideas, to work out problems, and that ability being curtailed by the actions of, in this case, the Canadian state, but we know it's happening all around the world.
Obviously, Tim Farron resigned recently. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, this is one of several cases. Also, the response to the DUP, where the idea of someone having what would until not very long ago, half a generation ago, have been viewed as normal, middle of the road, Christian-inspired beliefs and worldview. If anyone has those now, they're essentially being hounded out of politics. The response from Jeremy Corbyn to the announcement of the DUP's agreement with the Conservatives was that these people have to be essentially silenced and resisted because of their social conservatism. So to be socially conservative now is something that means that you apparently have no right to political representation anymore. This is another example, this case from the left, of closing down ideas, closing down debate. My view on Mr. Farden is not particularly supportive. He was challenged on this, and I think he basically lied for political purposes and wimped out. He should have been prepared to have the debate. If people are going to come after him about his Christianity and his beliefs versus liberalism, that's a debate he should surely have had, and made it quite expressed that there is a difference between the political role and the religious role, and made the view that, or expressed the view that liberalism means that Christians as well are entitled to political representation. He didn't make that view. He essentially, I think, lied about it. So I wasn't very impressed with his performance. But it is interesting to note that the reason given for his removal from office was Christian faith.
One of the things that staggered me about this Independent article about the DUP, the headline is, "I'm an Irish woman who grew up in the safe DUP seat. Britain is in for a shock." And it's an opinion piece, but nonetheless, one of the early comments is, you know, they believe in this, they believe in that. They even don't believe in global warming. And
yes, which is a belief. Well, at least they're recognizing this is entirely a matter of belief now. Yes. So there we go.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, the lack of belief in global warming, the links, there's a list of crimes that are held against the DUP. Being anti-abortion is very high in the list, and ignores all of the damage that is doing to our society and to the unborn child. Taking a traditional view of marriage is held up there, and indeed not believing in the new faith of global warming is held up there. Alleged links with terrorist organisations tends to come quite far down the list.
It's not so important.
If I may just add a bit on that before we move on to the subject of defence and military matters. Isn't it interesting that Farron is saying, well, I can't be part of the Lib Dems as a Christian. So we're getting from that statement that in his view, the Lib Dems themselves cannot be a Christian organisation. And of course, we've had the British government under Labour, if I remember the date correctly, might possibly have been at the beginning of Cameron's reign, approving Satanism for use on board British warships. So we've got a British government that now is saying, well, Satanism is fine. You can talk about that. You can practice that in the military. But we're now at the stage where we don't want Christianity, and I'm going to say in any of the mainstream political parties, because this is counter to the political correct discussion, which you've just previously highlighted with respect to the man in Canada. So we are now seeing a complete inversion, in my opinion, of morality. And one of the things that we know is coming along in policy is the drive for a one world religion, This is going to be the melting pot where anything goes. You can be Christian, Muslim, pagan, Satanist, Luciferian, whatever you like, but that one world religion will be approved as part of the UN agenda. This is something deeply sinister, David. Just a brief comment at this stage. I think we'll have to keep it for another time. But this is something deeply sinister, which is coming to the surface now through our governing system.
Deeply sinister, yes. Christianity is defined as bigotry. Satanism is defined as diversity. So there you go. There is, of course, a reason why they're particularly singling out Christianity for attack. I've got to hear a quote from an 18th century Scottish Glassite theologian from the Perth area. He said the coalition between church and state is essentially inconsistent with spiritual Christianity. I think he was right then. I think he's right now.
Okay, thank you for that. Well, let's chop across to the subject of defence, and we're just going to drop this one in as a bit of black humour because we've got a Ford aircraft carrier. This is Gerald R. Ford. And massive ship. Just highlight these two figures on the front of the flight deck. So absolutely vast ship. It's cost $13 billion so far, but it can't actually launch aircraft properly, despite the fact that they've apparently spent nearly $1 billion on simply the catapult system. And I was intrigued in the Bloomberg article that we've used here that they say this is due to sort of digital matters. They talk about digital and fundamental, so I presume it's a digital fundamental problem. David Ellis, this seems to be just the nation to produce an aircraft for the British aircraft carriers. That'd be the F-35B, of course, which we're hoping will arrive in a material form, but it's having a few snags. Just before we move on to the subject of EU military unification, what is going on?
Well, that's a really good question, isn't it? You know, as if the plane itself and the whole project isn't turning into a like a bucket of bolts or something or other. We've got this catapult launching thing. So it's quite ironic, really, because we've had this problem with the two carriers, the Queen Elizabeth and Prince of Wales. So as if the whole program from start to finish with adopting a French design and the drama with the reactors and Rolls-Royce and this continual meddling, delays, costs and so on and so forth. The original envelope was that they were going to be catapult launched F-35s. That decision was changed. And in changing that decision, there are two things happened. There was a huge penalty, a huge amount of extra costs issued onto the MOD and the budget of the project because of flip-flopping between the variations between the B and C F-35. But more importantly, here in Rugby, Convoteam, who were making the catapults, British company, well-established, 100-year-old British company, ended up losing their factory here in Rugby, and it went to GE.
General Electric.
So in this whole process here, and I mean, this is what's really ridiculous, is that steam catapult system was invented by the British and was used on our Royal Navy aircraft carriers, you know, quite successfully for many, many, many decades until we lost the Ark, you know, the old Ark Royal, not the one that was scrapped under Cameron in 2010, that fixed wing capability went. So all that technology all went with it. It was all British system. And now, you know, we've got a kind of business is war syndrome opening up with all this because it's an utter nonsense. The agenda isn't about making ships and making aircraft. The agenda is something completely different.
Which is big profit for that defence industry. Okay, well, let's move on to the danger of the EU. Now, I've got four particular slides that you prepared here. If I just roll through them, we can come back to any of them individually for you to take us through the meaning. But I've got the Bruges group here saying that the government agrees to EU military. That's a pretty significant headline from the Bruges group. We've got this one here, which shows General Lord Richards and William Hague at Lord Ashcroft's party in his new club. And this one, composite, I've got Get Britain Out, who are claiming that Brexit is still on track. And that's being written by former Vote Leave chief executive Matthew Elliott. And then coupled with that, we've got Get Britain Out showing...
Federica.
Yes, thank you very much, Federica. And the headline is exclusive, Britain is sleepwalking into joining an EU army. And that actually has also been reported in the Express, which is listed underneath. Actually, I can call that one on. We can have a look at that in a bit of detail. So where would you like to start? Would you like to start with Miss Mogherini and sleepwalking, or should we hop across?
Right. Okay, let's start with the sleepwalking thing. So this is Veterans for Britain. So this is David Banks, Lee Rotherham, and the officer frontage of Julian Thompson, Roger Lane Knott, General Guthley, Richard Kemp, General Jonathan Riley. If anybody I've left out, I apologise, but there's their front lineup. Right, let's get one thing perfectly straight. We're nobody sleepwalking into anything. The Conservative regime are actually doing this, you know, so that's frankly a little bit of, that's the wrong words there, and let's use the right words because they count. And we want the general public to assess and evaluate this properly, even if the MPs are not and Parliament is not, because obviously all of this has been done outside of Parliament. No debate, no scrutiny, no evaluation. So we're really seeing the hijacking of not just the Crown military. And I'm using this is very strong terms here. So let's nobody start balking. The hijacking of the Crown military and thereby the nation. So Julian Thompson's a great example here, and he said in 1982 with the Falklands, no carrier, no chance. And that's, I believe that's a correct statement, and I think this guy knows what he's talking about. So in this instance, in 2017, in terms of Brexit, okay, everybody just, let's look at this objectively. No British military, no chance. It's as simple as that. So this is up on our Twitter feed, at Strategic Defence. There's this sequence of tweets that I've picked up on here from these other parties are on there. Please start retweeting them. Let's see if we can get a Twitter barrage going here, because the Bruges Group have picked this up. So they are the very much the kind of anti-EU bridgehead into Parliament. They've got a board of MPs and a board of following and experts and entourage. So for them to pick this up and use it, but fair enough, it's a posthumous announcement because it's been done. But nonetheless, we must raise awareness, and we've got to push hard now, because what we want is these senior officers to start speaking out and using the right language and really going for this. Otherwise, nothing's going to change.
David, sorry, if I can just interject there, something I'd just like to stress for viewers and listeners, that in having this debate about Britain's military at the moment, we are not coming in to say, well, we need a beefed up British military in order to carry out the foreign policy we're seeing in the Middle East, for example, at the moment. What we are warning about is that the Conservatives, with a barrage of lies, are continuing to hand Britain's military over to the European Union. And this is now on a knife edge. If Britain's military forces continue down the path they're going, they will ultimately be under the control of the European Union, and therefore we no longer exist as a nation state. This is the meat of it.
Right. And the thing that's concerning me most at the minute, David, is that if we look at how this has played out over the last 12 to 18 months, it began with denials that this was happening at all. But most of the headlines now are saying, yes, it is happening, but it's happening because Britain has stepped back and is allowing it to happen. So Britain is no longer arguing against it, but the implication is that Britain's not taking any part in it. And this is disingenuous at best. And I'm just looking at that Bruges Group tweet, and they're kind of saying the same things. So we've got to get this message through that Britain has been part of this from the beginning.
That's quite correct. Yeah, the top echelons in the parties and regime have been complicit with all this. So you're quite correct with what you're saying, that they are heavily involved. There's been no challenging in any quarter. It's been hijacked out of parliamentary committees, and where the money flows and the scrutiny did start to look like it was taking shape between Defence Committee and the Foreign Affairs Committee. It was hijacked again. So we're seeing a kind of a very sophisticated engineering here and Whitehall nobbling to get the debate stopped. So it's down to the sort of big hitting officers really to actually come out and say that, you know, this is the case, because it's very simple. Now, I'm not suggesting, you know, I'm not advocating any kind of warmongering at all with this, but I'm just saying, as a matter of principle, is if we don't have control of our own military, we are not a nation. It's as simple as that. It's a vital state leg of the table. It's a vital component to be a nation. So the EU's gain here in gaining our military in military union. So it's not an EU army. It's not something they're going to generate. They're going to consume ours in union. It's the same process as what the currency went through in Europe. The unification of all the national currencies into one. They unified all of the individual currencies across the EU zone into one, the euro, administered by the ECB via the Bank of International Settlements, so as master bank, which the Bank of England is a shareholder of. So we're going to see the same process here with national militaries across the EU zone being unified into one force. So this is then the debate, obviously, what's that going to do? It's the same as what our military would do as if we retained it. So that's a very separate debate. And I'm not entering into that. I'm saying, just as a matter of a fundamental, we don't stop this now, we will not just lose our military. We will lose the budgetary control. We'll lose the policy control completely. We'll lose the capital budgets and the operational budgets of what it would do. And the EU will decide where all that money is spent and on what. And of course, as David already said earlier on with one of the other facets he was seeing in another field, of course, this is a complete stitch up, because what you'll see is that parties that are directors within defence companies sit on the scrutiny panels and the advisory panels to the EU to tell them where to put place the contracts. So we're seeing the same thing here in defence. So for these guys here, Veterans of Britain and the Bruges Group, to be now putting this up, everyone has got to leap on it. It's a vital issue. There will be no Brexit if we don't have a military. It's as simple as that. And what Theresa May is doing is surrendering it without a debate. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. David, Wednesday was the 35-year anniversary of the end of the Falklands conflict, and they rolled out Alan Duncan to make some commentary on it. And he said, you know, basically that while we're in better relations with Argentina now than we were at the time, he said, our resolve to support the Falkland Islands remains just the same as it did 35 years ago. Well, they don't have any way of maintaining that level of resolve, because the assets have gone.
Completely, yeah. There's absolutely, you know, there's no chance. That's a nonsense. There's quite a few senior brass said that, you know, that the islands are vulnerable as it stands at the moment. And I can see a lot of counsel with what they're saying. I mean, Alan Duncan's a good example there, really. I think now's probably the time, Brian, for you to invite David Banks on the show, and get him to talk about apparently this communication that's going between committees that's involving Alan Duncan. I think that's quite an important issue, but he's got the first hand information on that, and I think it would be good if we went straight to source and got him to talk about that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, will we run through this one?
Well, I think we should.
Okay, well, unaccompanied children. Let me just get to where I need to be on this. This week, the UN Migration Agency joined what they described as civil society and UN initiative calling for global compacts to protect migrant children. So they want to see global compacts to protect migrant children. They're saying, with intergovernmental discussions heading up to the global compacts on migration and refugees currently taking place, all parties must work together to address the needs of migrant children consistent with their human rights. And so a few days ago, the Global Conference on Children on the Move, which took place in Berlin, UN Migration Agency joined more than 20 other United Nations and civil society organizations, and they say they did that to unite around the rights of children, especially rights on the move. Well, what did William Lacy Swing, the Director General, say? He said, we want to ensure that child migration is always in the best interests of the child. That's a spectacular statement, Brian.
I'm silent, Mike, because I don't know what to say on this subject anymore, because it's just obvious that what we're told is always the direct opposite of what's going on.
Well, but to ensure that child migration is always in the best interest of the child, there's, again, with this meeting and with these types of meetings, there's no discussion of the causes of the problem. There's no discussion of why these children are in the position that they are. moving halfway across the world. They are dealing with the symptom rather than with the cause. And let's just bring Tim Farron back into this, because he's disappeared from the leadership of the Liberal Democrats Party, but he still has a lot of questions to answer over his calls to continue bringing unaccompanied child migrants from Syria to the UK in the full knowledge that there's no protection for them here. So he still has questions to answer. You know, this situation doesn't get any better. We're finding more and more evidence now of children being stolen into the sex trade and also into the organs trade. And this needs to stop.
Absolutely. David Ellis, just 30 seconds to close, as you like.
Yeah, Brian, could you put the slide back up of William Hague and General Richards?
Should be able to. Where are we? There we
Great. Okay. If everybody can just think back when William Hague was leader of the Conservatives, he ran a campaign to keep the pound and stay out of EU currency unification. And we've got General Lord Richards here, heavily sort of campaigning, written a lot in the Times. We were lucky to have a sort of dialogue with him at the start of Brexit to do with this number 10 letter that Cameron had appended his name on without authority. So he took his name in vain, along with a lot of other officers. So what I'm saying here is to William Hague, there's no excuse here now with you top brass senior Tories and Lords. Where's your campaign to keep the British military? Yeah. You were prepared to stay out of currency union. Now explain to me where the logic is that you're going into military union and what your argument there is and why it has not gone through any parliamentary process. It's not in anybody's manifesto. Nobody's had a mandate to do it. You're completely, utterly, operating outside of any parliamentary office or scrutiny. You know, you've taken their names in vain. And I'm saying to you, well, I'm submitting a question to him. Did you take the Crown's name in vain as well while you were doing it?
Okay, David, thank you. And David Scott?
I'd like to close just with pointing out the children's rights agenda is in fact a covert, a sleeket assault on the family, on the rights of families to be left alone. And when you split children off from parents, which this legislation and rights agenda does, the children are then terribly, terribly vulnerable to be nothing more than merchandise. Not very long ago, I sat down with an extremely impressive young woman who had been trafficked from the UK care system to the UK prostitution industry. She was 14 at the time. This is happening today. This is happening all across the UK right now, and we do nothing to stop it. That's why we need to be concentrating on families and genuinely looking after children, because without that protection, they are prey.
Okay, David, thank you for that. And I will just end by saying I hope over the weekend people reflect on the fact that Tim Farron has said that the Lib Dems are no longer Christian. It's not compatible. And we have all three of the main political parties not protecting children, but approving the use of Satanism. I think what's coming is pretty obvious here, and it's time we called it out for what it is. Mike, anything to say? No. Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining us. Thank you to all our viewers and listeners. Can I say, if you're not a subscriber to the UK column at the moment, we do need your help to keep us doing what we do. We need your support in donations or subscriptions. So if you've been watching UK Column for free, you like what we do, you value what we do, we need your support with those subscriptions and donations. We simply cannot do this on Fresh Air, and everything we do costs money, whether it's keeping the studio running, but increasingly it's paying other costs. If people want to come and give us information, valuable information, they can't pay for their travel. We can't set up meetings. We do try and help people. We're grateful for all of the money that's come in when we've been trying to help particular cases. That's very much appreciated. But here we are as the UK column. We think we're still central to exposing what's really taking place in the United Kingdom today. If you want to see us continue, we need your financial help in those subscriptions. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.